This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is urging Floridians to get vaccinated against the coronavirus, saying that the shots are, quote, saving lives. In a press conference on Wednesday, DeSantis told reporters that 95% of the people being admitted to hospitals in the state due to COVID-19 complications haven't been vaccinated at all.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon. You heard the news there, right? Glad you're with us today. I'm Drew Mariani. We got a lot to talk about. I hope you'll hang out with me. Great show ahead. That was the latest news from the Hill on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis recommending vaccinations. Some of you might be saying, what? Really? Florida? Yeah, he's on board. A lot going on in the world of vaccines. I want to talk about mandates and whether or not vaccines, the virus is mutating and the vaccines are ineffectual. There's so much to get into with this. And I'll tell you what, a national football team, a major NFL team, is having their players do and wear in regards to COVID-19. It was, it gave me pause. And maybe because of the color, maybe because of the suggestion. But I'll tell you about that coming up in just a few minutes here. So stay with me, okay? We got a lot to talk about here. And of course, you're welcome anytime. You want to join the conversation? You've got something you want to share? It's 888-914-9149. All right. You know, a few months of freedom we've all had, right? I mean, I love not wearing a mask. And there's a lot of concern. School starting, and I know a lot of parents don't want to have to mask their kids back up again. Dr. Rachel Walensky, she's the director of the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. She said yesterday that there is new science. This is the words that they're using, okay? There's new science showing that the Delta variants, they behave differently than the strain of the COVID-19 virus that, you know, it can infect people who've been vaccinated. So just so you hear me clearly on this point, I just want to kind of reiterate this. You've been vaccinated. You might have had your J&J. You might have had your Moderna. You might have had your Pfizer vaccine. You know, you might be vaccinated and you think, I'm safe. I don't need to wear a mask. I'm not going to catch it. I'm not going to spread it, right? That's not what the CDC director is saying. She's saying, you know what? It's very possible due to mutations that it can affect people who've been vaccinated. And a little bit later, we'll speak to a former member of the CDC who's going to be stopping by. We'll get his take on that. But she says, look, this is a rare case of some vaccinated people infected with the virus after vaccination may be contagious and they may spread it. That means, she says, that everyone, including those who have been vaccinated, you should mask up when you're in public places. All right, man, I don't know how you feel about that, if you're okay with that. To me, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. She's been recommending that, you know, everyone at school wear a mask, even the kids, even though it's shown time and time again. Look, the chance of kids getting this is very, very low, very low. So the solution, according to the CDC, is, you know what, just more people got to get vaccinated. That's how we're going to resolve this. Everybody get vaccinated, apparently. Most of the new cases being reported are from areas where there are low vaccination rates. So it's just something to think about. The Biden administration now, though, is recommending fully vaccinated individuals don their mask once again, and you know every week this information changes. Here's what CNBC had to say about it. Listen to this report.
According to sourcing from NBC News as well as us, we are hearing that the Biden administration is likely to come out with a change in mask guidance, potentially in areas of high transmission, recommending that even fully vaccinated folks in certain areas wear masks indoors. This would be a reversal from the CDC's guidance that anybody who's fully vaccinated doesn't need to wear a mask indoors, and comes as we are hearing that there is new data suggesting that even fully vaccinated individuals may carry high loads of virus high enough that they could be contagious to other people. It is still believed that the majority of the transmission of the Delta variant virus in general is being driven by unvaccinated people. But because of these new data that are emerging suggesting fully vaccinated people can transmit the virus in high transmission areas, we do expect potentially to see that change coming from the CDC and the administration today. No word yet on exactly what time, and we'll bring you any more details that we get. But the shows just how much more of a risk the Delta variant and how highly transmissible it is.
Yeah, and look, I'll break all this down. I'm just getting you plugged into the news right now. A little bit later, we're going to take a look at some news regarding the mutation of COVID, whether or not your vaccine is effective. We're going to take a look at new reports coming up that claim that some people are now getting neurological problems, Parkinson's and others. We'll take a look at the whole issue of mandates, whether or not, the Department of Justice was looking at whether or not this was legal or not. I'll tell you what they had to say, and we'll take a look at who's mandating that these masks be worn. So there's a lot coming up a little bit later if you want to join in on that conversation. Love to have it. Also, Pfizer and Moderna are expanding their studies of whether or not kids 5 to 11 years old should be vaccinated. Now, when I hear these pharmaceutical companies do this, and look, I'm not anti-vaccine, don't get me wrong. I just see a dollar sign. Yeah, we're going to vaccinate 5 to 11 years old when the risk of them getting it is so low. Oh, you need a third booster. Do I really? Maybe I do. Maybe if you can resolve the mutation issue. How about coming out with a new one that covers all that for those unvaccinated people? So you don't have to keep going back for these things. But we'll look at that coming up here in just a few moments. In other news, though, the Olympics, did you catch any of it at all? I watched it last night. The ratings are way down. I talked about this the other day, and they're as low as they've been in 33 years, over three decades. You know, the viewership has just dropped precipitously. And there was big news in gymnastics, and gymnastics and swimming tend to be the most watched, most, you know, coveted of all the Olympic events. Simone Biles, who is, they call her the greatest of all time. She's just a superstar. She does things that nobody really can even compete against. And she's taking a lot of heat because, she pulled out due to mental health reasons, she said. She's been expected to lead her team to another gold medal. In fact, their Russian team, the coach there said, oh, if she's out, there goes 70% of the team. Of course, the U.S. took silver, but they did lose to the Russians. The backdrop is this. She stumbled on the vault, right? She went off by herself. She came back telling her coach that she was withdrawing. And she apparently wasn't in what she called the right headspace, is how she referred to it. And she thought she wasn't going to be anytime soon, so she decided she wasn't going to compete. She said she didn't want to blow her chance of the team winning a medal, which they did. Again, they took silver instead of gold. And I was talking to my producing team about this earlier today because I'm on the fence as to, you know, how to feel about this. So the woman has legitimate, you know, issues mentally. I want to respect that. But part of training is both physical and mental for these types of Olympics. You are representing this nation. You are part of a team. A lot of people are dependent upon you. And again, I'm going to be very careful about what I say because I'm not walking in her shoes. But I heard this piece on CBS, and apparently these reporters looked into it. And they spoke to sports medicine specialists, and they talked about maybe she was concerned about her safety. Maybe she's concerned about her own health. If you're not in the right place, you can get hurt. I mean, look at those parallel bars. Look at that beam. I mean, I'd be scared to death as a father letting my daughter even learn gymnastics, to be honest with you. I would. But she dropped out of the competition. What's driving that? Check this out. CBS looked into the psychology behind the decision.
Well, I have to tell you, we even heard from Katie Ledecky, another superstar, big name here at the Olympics, right? And she said that she hopes that Simone Biles continues to focus on her mental health and does what's right for her. That's pretty much the sentiment that you're hearing from other athletes. They're proud of her. They think that this was a tremendous amount of strength to show that she was able to say, you know what, I need a timeout, I need a pause, I need to reevaluate what I'm doing here. Many athletes also pointing out in the gymnastics world that, you know, your mental health and physical health are really tied together, especially in that sport where there is such a little sliver room for error that you could really hurt yourself. And I think that's what we potentially saw when she did that vault. She came down. She had that look on her face. She did not like how she landed. That's one thing that you don't like how you performed. But I think you could see some sports psychologists we talked to said you could see that, you know, she also was struggling because if those two don't match, you don't know how you're going to perform the rest of the event, which means you could potentially get hurt. And talking to that sports psychologist today as well, you know, we really learned that this shows that our superheroes can be human. And I think that's what a lot of people are taking away from this, that even Simone Biles, who really in the grand scheme of things, is still the best in the world when it comes to gymnastics. She doesn't have that much to prove that she's incredible at her sport. If she's saying, you know what, I've been through a lot in my life, especially, you know, she's a sexual assault survivor by her trainer, Larry Nassar. She was somebody who grew up in foster care, was adopted by her grandparents. She's overcome so much that if this is the time that she says, I need a timeout, people seem to be supporting it.
And it's tough for Team USA, but you heard some of the reasoning behind there. As I said, I'm not walking in her shoes, so she's been really criticized for her decision, and she's going on an experience that she had 8 years ago when her coaches, they had to call her off the floor because of the same thing. This time around, she called herself out. But one other Olympic story here that I was looking at the flag that the Russians were flying under. I don't know if you noticed this or not. They have the letters ROC. Anybody notice that? And I'm thinking, why are the Russians flying under that flag? You know, I thought the Russians weren't even supposed to be at this Olympics. Do you remember what happened in the previous Olympics? I think it was the 2016 Olympics. You know, the World Anti-Doping Agency found that Russia was giving its athletes illegal drugs to improve their performance. I mean, it's so horrible. It's terrible, right? So Russia was banned from the international competition until the end of 2022. But Russia doesn't take defeat easily. So what did they do? And when you watch the Olympics, check this out. They got the International Olympic Committee to allow their athletes to compete under the banner of the Russian Olympic Committee, or ROC. You'll see ROC running around. I don't even know how I feel about that, to be honest with you. I feel terrible for the athletes, right, who train and who want to compete. And it's great to let them compete. Why not, right? But Russia, if you're going to dope, right, if you're going to cheat, then you should not be able to represent at all in the Olympics, right? You should not. You've been banned. So how do you do this end around? Everybody knows it's Russia, right? They're still competing, but they're competing as the ROC, the Russian Olympic Committee, as opposed to Russia. So strange. It's something that caught my attention last night, and I thought maybe if you're wondering, now you know. Out west, the drought continues, and it is really it's hitting the already scarce water sources pretty hard. I don't know if you've seen this. We talked about this several weeks ago. I'm continuing to monitor this because I think it's something seriously to be aware of. Water right now is at an all-time low in the lakes and reservoirs that provide water to much of the western U.S. And Bloomberg was reporting on this. They took a look at it, and they're going to give you a little history and insight into Lake Mead. Listen to this.
Lake Mead, formed after the Hoover Dam corked the Colorado River in 1935, is part of a broader network of natural and artificial aqueducts and dams. It supplies water to 40 million people, and homes, farms, manufacturers, and businesses across several states, tribal lands, and parts of Mexico.
Los Angeles, San Diego, Phoenix, Tucson, all of these cities would not have become as muscular and productive and robust as they now are without Colorado River water being harnessed at Hoover Dam and Lake Mead.
But the lake is shrinking faster and sooner than hydrologists and other experts predicted.
The water table has dropped so drastically that marinas around the lake have closed because the water level isn't high enough to launch boats. Over the last 20 years, the Lake Mead water table has been steadily, steadily, steadily dropping. And there are very key different elevation levels in the lake that determine when shortages are called. And we are about to approach Tier 1, which is the first formal shortage declaration. That will be next month.
If things don't stop, I'll tell you what, I'm afraid things might get a little bit worse. There's a photo. In fact, there's a photo series floating around online of Lake Oroville in California 3 years ago when it was full. And then there's a shot of it in April when it was half full. And then they took another shot just last week. I got to be honest with you, it's kind of frightening. It looks like there's just a small stream running through a bed of the lake. I mean, that should give us some pause. Lake Powell, created by the Glen Canyon Dam, is only about a third of its normal capacity. Its lowest level since 1963, and you heard in that report, Lake Mead, created by the Hoover Dam, which is the largest reservoir in the country, is also at a severely low level. The problem, of course, is that millions of people depend on that water from these sources. They depend on it a daily basis, and if things get worse, people who depend on that water, they're going to face having their supply. They're going to have to start cutting supplies next year. It's a tough situation. So let's say a prayer for that. Keep an eye on it. I'm praying this is just a cycle and things will get back. God is in control. Right? That's one thing I always think about. God's in control. I do think there's consequence for sin. I do think there's consequence for the rejection of God. I think sometimes the Lord drives us to our knees or makes us realize that we're not all powerful. We're not in control of everything. And sometimes events like this turn our eyes, or force some to turn to God and beg for his mercy, to ask for reprieve, to pray for rain, to pray for cooler temperatures, pray to the end of the wildfires, whatever it may be. And as you gaze at the sky and you gaze into space, I think so often that's when I see God more than anything, the mystery of the universe, the vastness of it. You know, they've often said that the universe is infinite, right? At least that's what was popularly thought. And I think most of us tend to think of it as having kind of a flat shape and just continually expanding, right? Getting larger and larger and larger. Objects moving away. We hear that, in fact, that's what has been taught for a long time, that the universe is still expanding after the Big Bang, and it's filled with this infinite number of galaxies that just keep going away from the center. Let me ask you a question. I'm serious. I saw something that really opened my eyes, and Father Chris Corbelly from the Vatican Astronomy is going to be joining me in a second here. What if that theory was wrong? What if the universe is not expanding? What if there were other ways that the universe might be shaped, and we've had this wrong all along? Well, there's a geophysicist at the University of Lyon in France, and he thinks, well, that's the case. According to LiveScience.com, examining light from the very early universe, it's giving them a new theory. Thomas Boucher, him and a team of astrophysicists have deduced that our cosmos may be multiply connected, meaning that space is closed in on itself in three dimensions, like a three-dimensional donut. I know it's sometimes hard to follow, right? But such a universe would be finite. And according to what they theorized, our entire cosmos might only be maybe 3-4 times larger than the limits of the observable universe, about maybe 45 billion light years away. That's amazing. That to me is absolutely stunning. On top of that, if the universe is ever expanding, its existence would go on forever. But a finite universe that's closed in on itself could collapse on itself. So let's talk about it. I'm not the expert here. Father Chris Corbelly is. He's a Jesuit priest who's a research astronomer at the Vatican Observatory. And I always love tapping into his expertise. And he joins us this afternoon. Father, thank you for being here. Good afternoon.
Drew, it's always wonderful to be with you and certainly to hear your explanations of the universe and God did that.
Gosh, I'm actually embarrassed by my explanation of the universe because I sit at your feet. I mean, you're the expert here. I, in my very feeble intellect, try to explain what I read and see and hear. And now explain this to us. I mean, what the modern theory, Big Bang, let's talk about the expanding universe and then this new theory. I mean, how much credibility? It has yet to be tested from what I understand, but, some of the data there looks pretty compelling. But let me throw the ball in your court. Break it down for us, if you could.
Thank you, Drew. But one thing I must make clear, I'm not a cosmologist. I'm, I suppose, a star man. I investigate stars and their life cycles, what we call their evolution, rather than the cosmos as a whole. But obviously, I do physics and I'm interested in the cosmos as a whole. And certainly this idea of the expanding universe is the one that makes the most sense. May I just sort of go back a little bit on what you said, this kind of dome nut model that we're getting at the moment. So it's changing the shape, the look of the universe, but it's not changing the expansion of the universe as such. So this donut is expanding.
Wow.
So whether, if we keep going in our spaceship, we'll just imagine yourself on the surface of a donut, we'll kind of come back and start finding our tail, the tail end of the spaceship as we keep going around. I think not, simply because of the faster than light speed expansion of the universe itself. So that's just a little modification. But the shape of it, yeah, that's a fascinating thought. Rather than what we've had so far, a flat universe. Oh, so uninteresting.
So is there a way to test this theory? And does it matter, even whether we're donut or flat?
I don't know for each of us whether it matters. What we could go through our lives much the same way, whatever the shape of the universe. We're not going to be able to go faster than light for the moment, but let's not preclude that, leave it out. We always possible, and there are theoreticians and practical people, even at NASA, working on whether we can, in fact, travel faster than light. So that's always a possibility.
But on that point, I don't want to diverge too much here, but I just want clarity on that point. I thought, you know, Einstein said it was impossible to travel faster than the speed of light.
Usually, and under Einstein, yes. But if we can get into a little space-time bubble, then we might well be able to drive to go faster than light. So this is an idea that came up, you know, so a while ago. If you look at Alcubierre Drive, again a Frenchman, they're wonderful, aren't they, especially theoreticians. That's something that NASA's been looking into seriously. Now, I haven't heard of recent work on that, but yeah, it's been a serious investigation. Let's not leave it anything saying that's impossible.
Right. Well, you know, if this is indeed the case, and you can travel faster than the speed of light, let's just say there's another, and this is all hypothetical, another civilization that somehow has been able to achieve that level of science and mathematics, you know, then you could travel vast distances. What do you make of all these UFO reports that the you know, Congress just asked for and was released? I mean, a lot of these anomalies, they can't explain a number of them. They're in U.S. airspace. What's your take on that? As a Catholic priest and as a cosmologist, or as an astronomer, I should say, as a star man.
Astronomer, starman, but yeah, with an interest in cosmology, clearly, and also with an interest in these UFOs. Again, as I said, let's not say something is impossible. Right. It's impossible to go faster than light. And yes, it could be another intelligent civilization visiting us. But that's, again, always the most remote explanation.
Exactly.
And we should always look for other ones nearer at hand, including, as I say, this of the universe. This idea of the donut, yes, but theoreticians can always come up with wonderful explanations. And really, it's just one fact, interesting fact behind this, of basically the scale of the temperature variations in the universe that's behind this. So it's just one thing. But it's an intriguing thing, and that's always the point. It's fascinating.
Well, Father, I want to thank you for your time. It is fascinating. I'd love to see how this all shakes out, whether or not the universe is donut-shaped or if it's flat. I mean, what it does, it points back to the reality that God is a great mystery, and he is so creative and so loving. One of the great ways that we can find him, I think, is often just looking at these wonderful mysteries. You'll find him at the center of it all. That's Father Chris Corbelly. Great to have him here with us, a Jesuit priest and a research astronomer from the Vatican Observatory.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
All the news and issues
now
that are happening now.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, you got to check this story out. Wait till you hear what's coming up. I try to bring you good news. I also just try to keep you informed. There is an attack, I believe, on religious freedom in our country. I think it's going to intensify. We need to defend conscience rights in this country. You know, remember Jack Phillips, the cake designer in Colorado? He now has has company in the section of the state reserved for people being forced to do things against their conscience. You remember Baronelle Stutzman, who also joined him. She was from Washington State, and of course the Supreme Court wouldn't take up her case. There is somebody else is joining the club. You know, you've got bakers, you got photographers. Now you got a web designer. Wait to hear the story. This came across my radar the other day, and I thought, look, we need to. It's what you'd be aware of it. All right. There's a woman named Lori Smith, and she has started a business. It's called 303 Creative, and she does custom design websites, primarily for weddings, right? It's her little niche. So you already know where this is heading, right? She actually hasn't started doing it because of the Colorado Anti-Discrimination Act. It forbids her from not turning down any business request from anyone, even if that person wants her to design a website for, let's say, a so-called same-sex wedding, which she says, I just can't do. I'm not going to use my creativity. I'm not going to use my talent. I'm not going to use all the things I have invested in to promote something that's diametrically opposed to what I believe and what I hold is true. And you can understand that, right? These violate her religious beliefs. And of course, this is just a classic case of freedom of religion and freedom of speech. And her appeal to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals should have, I think, and again, I'm not the expert here, should have been easily won. Actually, she should have easily won at the district court level, but she didn't. And it just gives me pause. The 10th Circuit Court, they made a 2-1 decision that my next guest called bonkers. That's what he called this this decision. The majority acknowledged that the Anti-Discrimination Act compels speech, which violates the First Amendment, and the portion of the law that says that all businesses must equally accommodate everyone also restricts speech because it will only allow speech if the business owner accommodates people she doesn't want to work for. So the judges got it wrong with a, you know, basically got it wrong. You know, so the majority decision goes on to make an extremely illogical conclusion. If the court exempted Lori from the law, she would be denying her unique services to same-sex couples. So, you know, they would be forced then to seek inferior accommodations. And the court said, you know, that was more wrong than compelling speech and violating Lori's conscience. So where's it heading? You know, we're going to see more of this. And what does this mean for others in other industries? Maybe you. I'm joined right now by a very distinguished senior fellow in the Antonin Scalia Chair in Constitutional Studies. He's, I think, edited three of the works of Antonin Scalia. He is joins us from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, which you can find at EPPC.org. And it's good to have Ed Whalen with me today. And how many works did you edit of Justice Scalia? Was it three?
Well, three volumes, a collection of his speeches. Wow. It's actually a New York Times bestseller called Scalia Speaks. It came out in 2017. A work of his thoughts on matters of religion and faith called On Faith. It came out in 2018. And then just last year, The Essential Scalia. So that's focused on his legal writings.
I wonder where Justice Scalia would be on this story here. You know, I mean, Lori Smith hasn't even started designing websites yet. I mean, she hasn't even begun. So, you know, why did she bring a suit? What's going on here? What's happening?
Well, she was trying to get clarity that she, you know, whether or not she would be able to operate this design company offering wedding websites without facing massive penalties. And what's most remarkable about the Tenth Circuit opinion here, the majority opinion, is that it actually teed up her free speech interest in the strongest possible way. Have in mind that in the Baronel Stutzman and Jack Phillips cases you referred to, there were disputes about whether baking a cake or arranging flowers is really expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment. In this case, the judge who wrote the majority opinion said that the creation of wedding websites is pure speech. She said that the law forced the website owner to create websites that they would otherwise refuse, that this was a content-based restriction that had to satisfy strict scrutiny, had to be state had to show a compelling interest, and the law had to be narrowly tailored. These are all legal buzzwords, but what they're saying is you had to meet the highest possible standard in order to rule against the website owner. And then the court, in this very strange twist, said, and somehow that standard has been met. And the argument, which you know, I'm not, you know, I spent a lot of time reading poorly crafted opinions, but this one has to take the cake for quite a while. She basically said that the website designer is providing unique services that are by definition unavailable elsewhere. Never mind that there are plenty of websites out there that can offer, you know, wedding websites. Other people can come in and do it anytime. But somehow this service that she hasn't offered, it hasn't even started providing yet, the court says, it's in the nature of a monopoly. And that it basically in that market, the court says, only this one website owner exists. Therefore, it's narrowly tailored to require that this person make her services available to folks who want to celebrate same-sex marriages. So it's taking the expressive conduct and the creativity and somehow twisting that into a justification for conscripting this person to be a messenger for views that she objects to on religious grounds.
Yeah. My guest today, Ed Whalen, if you want to join us, I'll open the phones. We'll take a few calls. The number here is 888-914-9149. And taking a look at the 10th Circuit decision in Colorado regarding a web designer who hasn't even really begun designing her website yet. And I think this is the beginning. I know you called this decision bonkers. I want to get your take on that as well. But let me start with Pammy. She's listed in Addison, Illinois. She's got a question for you. Pammy, good afternoon.
Hi. Real quick question. Facebook, they are denying conservatives their free speech because they can, because they are their own entity company. Okay? Mm-hmm. These are all entity companies. Why are they being denied their quote-unquote free speech? Free to whatever, and yeah, so that's pretty much the bottom line. Is it because they got a bunch of money and they got all this, or, you know, help me?
Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, they're a private company. A lot of people say, hey, government can't tell, you know, that Facebook can censor whoever they want, right? They can set up laws as to what they're going to permit on their site. Why can't she do the same thing as a private entity?
Well, the answer to that is there's a law out there that Section 230 that provides some sort of immunity to companies like Facebook that basically let anyone express themselves on their website. So that's not what we're talking about with this website designer. She wants to provide her own design. She's not interested in having various people come on and comment. So it's a different legal issue. The two are related in some way, and you know, Facebook in particular is far closer to a monopoly in its field, if it's not already, than this you know, wedding website that hasn't even started. So there is a case, and I think some folks are exploring it for imposing on Facebook some sort of equal access or non-discrimination requirement so that it doesn't bar people on political grounds. But here what we have is, in the Colorado case, you have the conflict between the website designer's First Amendment rights and this very, very expansive anti-discrimination law in Colorado that goes, you know, far beyond the laws we had in the 1960s that were necessary and justified in order to make it possible for African Americans, say, to travel around and you know, visit relatives, do tourism, and know that they'll have hotels and restaurants open to them where they can rest and eat. Here we're talking about wedding websites that can be provided literally anywhere in the world. The competition for this service is unlimited, but somehow this particular website designer is told that if she's going to offer websites that celebrate opposite-sex marriages, she has to offer wedding websites that celebrate same-sex marriages, and that you know, the First Amendment gives her no protection against that, which, again, I think the court's analysis is simply bonkers.
Yeah, and you pointed out that there are a lot of other website designers out there. I mean, if this violates her conscience, can't somebody just go somewhere else? I mean, a lot of people make that particular argument. You know, just because her services won't be available to same-sex companies, that somehow or others kind of, you know, you're following what I'm saying. I'm not articulating
this.
The way
I'd put it is a website is not a motel.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that you come upon at the end of the day and you need in order to, you know, manage your life properly.
Right.
There are a zillion of them out there. This goes, I should emphasize more to the scope of the Colorado law, which is similar to many other laws. This notion that we can't count on the market to ensure that everyone is provided services, but we instead have to impose this broad non-discrimination requirement on everyone. Never mind when it conflicts with their free speech rights or their rights to religious liberty.
So what happens next? What happens next? Does this get appealed? And where does it go? Does it go all the way up to the Supreme Court at some point in time?
Well, it's only one step from the Supreme Court now. Right. I mean, this is a ruling by the Tenth Circuit, a federal court of appeals, the tier immediately below the Supreme Court. It's possible that the losing website design company might ask that the Tenth Circuit en banc as a whole court to reconsider this decision, whether that's a sensible procedural step or not. I'll have to leave to the lawyers in the case.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think that if review is sought in the Supreme Court on this ruling is so bad that I think it's likely to be summarily reversed by the Supreme Court, that is, without even needing oral argument. Now, have in mind, though, that this issue does relate to the Barron L. Stutzman case on which the Supreme Court regrettably denied review recently. And so it's possible that the court would take this would grant review and address some of the broader issues here. But this case, in some ways, is so easy that I'm not sure I'd see it as a sensible vehicle for doing so. But more broadly, you know, we're going to see this issue around us all the time. There are going to be more and more cases that present this, and the court is going to have to provide clarity. Yeah. Sooner rather than later. But also, let's have in mind, again, the underlying problem here is the breadth of the Colorado law, a law that is not by any stretch unique. So I think it's time that we get our legislators to look seriously at these laws and at least require as a threshold matter that if you say you're being deprived of something, you show that there are not plenty of other market alternatives readily available to you.
I think that's a great point, because look, it's a baker, it's a photographer, it is a web designer today, it'll be a wedding dress maker the next time, it'll be some other enterprise or industry. It's just going to be a different incarnation of that, and I think you're right. We need to address this, otherwise these stories are going to continue to come up until those laws are addressed. So we'll see. Hey, thank you. I hope the Supreme Court takes this one, if it goes that far, and I hope we get some clarity. And always good to talk to you. I appreciate you bringing clarity to this issue.
Thank you, Drew.
All right, that's Ed Whalen, Distinguished Senior Fellow in the Antonin Scalia Chair in Constitutional Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Check him out at eppc.org. That's where you get more information there. Look, I've said it before, when you redefine marriage, and we knew that was happening, there's bad fruit from bad decisions. You know, we saw what happened with no-fault divorce. We saw what happened with contraception. We saw what happened, the bad fruit, of course, of abortion, where that has led right now. You know, we have all these end-of-life issues, and we have all these threats in the womb. But you also saw, and I warned about this when this was going down with the Obergefell decision, when marriage was being redefined, you were going to see cases such as polyamory and polygamy, and the big cry out, oh, no, we just want to be married. We just want what you have. We're not going to do that. No. What do you see now? You see bakers, and you see photographers, and you see web designers, and you see all sorts of people now, being sued for the sake of being sued. And we saw that in a lot of these other particular cases, because a particular party wants to drive their point. You don't like, it's all about tolerance. You have to tolerate my sexual ethics and what I believe, but I'm not going to tolerate yours. You're going to make that cake for me. You're going to design that website. You're going to do what I want you to do. And to Ed's point, I think there's a lot of other alternatives out there, and I think we need to get this issue right. Otherwise, it's going to continue to manifest. So let's pray for tolerance, true tolerance, all right, true understanding. It's a two-way street. For some, It's not. It's more of a mantra. Today's a special day. You know how much I love St. Faustina, right? She's my girl. I love St. Faustina. She is one of my favorite saints. I think the saints choose us, to be honest with you. I think there are special saints in your life, and you have a special connection or affinity to them. I think they kind of connect to you. When I wrote my book on Divine Mercy, I dedicated a chapter in the book to the diary of St. Faustina. And the reason I did that is because it's such a unique work. So now there's a lot of visionaries, a lot of mystics who write things down. This is a little bit different. And when I come back, I'm going to tell you why. And I'm going to explain. And look, the diary's not an easy read. I know a lot of people have run out to get the diary. I personally found the diary kind of a harder read, right? I have a friend who's a bishop, and he and his sister every day would just take like a passage or a page and go through the diary that way. Very digestible, contemplate what the Lord was saying. It's a great way to do it. You sit down and say, I'm going to read the diary of St. Faustina like it's some novel or book. Not really going to fly. Well, maybe it will. I shouldn't say that. My attention span is maybe a little bit shorter. But I'll tell you what, I will give you some background on what I think is just an extraordinarily remarkable book and one that was given to us from heaven. Stay with me. I'll tell you the story.
Get caught up on this conversation and all the others by going to the Relevant Radio Archives. Just search for The Drew Mariani Show.
So good to be here with you today. Coming up in just a few moments, we will pray the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. And of course, you can always join me for that. I love that prayer. It's a powerful one. In fact, St. Faustina recorded the revelations that she received from our resurrected Lord, from Jesus Christ himself, in the diary of St. Faustina. That's why we have so much information about that particular encounter. I think it was 85, 86, maybe 87 years ago today that St. Faustina began writing her diary after having burned her first diary. I don't know if you know the story or not. She was tricked by the evil one. Yeah, so St. Faustina, I'll give you the quick thumbnail here because I have a few moments on it. She encountered this spiritual director, you know, and the Lord instructed her to go to him, and she was going to confession to him quite regularly, and you know, she began to reveal to him that she was having these encounters with Jesus Christ, and he wasn't sure how stable she was. He wasn't sure, you know, this nun's thinking that Jesus is speaking to her. So he went ahead and he had her psychologically evaluated. And I love this because I know many visionaries have gone through this too. They meet with competent officials. St. Faustina was given an absolutely clean slate saying that she was of sound mind, right? So he realized that, my gosh, this woman is actually having encounters with the risen Lord. So he says, you know, best, because her confessions be super long. And the other nuns felt like Faustina was getting preferential treatment. So he said to her, look, do this. When Jesus comes, write down all of the encounters that you have with him and everything that he instructs you to do. So St. Faustina began to do that. She recorded them initially on sheets of paper, and then she began to write a diary. And she had a vision one day, and it was of an angel, she thought. And the angel told her she should burn the book, the diary. The Lord wants her to burn that, you know. And, you know, he deceived her and told her that this was God's will, that, if, you know, out of humility she should do this. So St. Faustina burned the diary. Father Sopochko, at the same time, he was out on a, he was away. And when he came back, he asked to read what the Lord had given to her. And she told him what happened. And he instantly knew what happened. It was a fallen angel. It was an evil one. It was Satan who told her to burn that. So he instructed her to do it again. So when you read the diary, she had to do this from memory, right? So it's a second incarnation. I think maybe, you know, good comes out of every situation. Maybe there's a reason for it. I don't know. Would have rather have had the original stuff. Is it as accurate? Is it the same thing? I did an interview once with a man named Father Jake. What was his name again? Father Bliźniak?
It's Father Bliźniak, yes.
Father Bliźniak. A great proponent of Blessed Sopochko. And he was in studio with me. Now, he has a very heavy accent. We have a translator here. But he shared a story with me about... And I didn't know this at the time, that those pieces of paper, now I can't wait. You know, Louis de Montfort, before I tell you about Louis de Montfort, Faustina would write these messages from the Lord down on scraps of paper. They were kept in like a shoebox at one point. That shoebox has gone missing. Nobody knows where that is. Louis de Montfort's work was lost for over 100 years. Total consecration, you know, the book he did, 33-day consecration to, what is his title? True Devotion to Mary, I think it's called. It's the consecration that he wrote to John Paul II. It was lost for over a century. I think, this is just my own personal view, but I think perhaps one day in the future, those missing messages and secrets may come up. But listen to what he had to say. Jake pulled just a minute or two out of what was a much longer conversation with him, but this, I think, is telling.
Returning back to the question of the little notes, Father Sobotchko, before he told St. Faustina to write the diary, first he told her, why don't you just write down all of Jesus' demands on little pieces of paper, and when she would come to confession, she would bring those little notes of paper. Within a short time, she amassed a whole box of pieces of paper.
Wow.
Drew, you asked me what happened with those pieces of paper, those notes. Until the death of Father Sobotchko, those pieces of paper were found in Białystok, and shortly afterwards, a city where Father Sobotchko lived. At a certain point, all the notes disappeared. Why, we don't know. One thing is for sure, on these pieces of paper, there were certain texts that are not included in the diary. Those texts were more powerful, more apocalyptic, and it showed the magnitude of God's divine mercy. When I asked my predecessor as to why these notes disappeared, he was unable to answer. We are hopeful that truly they will be discovered somewhere.
Yes. Yeah. So two things just on this point here that I am so compelled by. They're missing. Are they like Louis de Montfort's work, lost for a period of time because God, in his infinite mercy, wants to reveal them at a time when the human race really needs them? Are they waiting for some point in the future? Now, you hear what she said. They were far more powerful and far more apocalyptic. Faustina had visions of Jesus manifesting. There'll be a visible sign in the sky where you'll see the crucified Lord. She spoke about, the Lord told her, and she recorded this in the diary, before I come as a just judge, I first come as a merciful Savior. But woe to those of you who do not recognize this time of my visitation. This is the time of mercy. This is the time we are living in. You and I are living in the time of mercy that Jesus Christ himself predicted. And yet look at the evil that is rising in our own day, huh? Look at the evil that is percolating. And we're redefining marriage. You know, we're attacking people of conscience. We are killing children. We're redefining gender. I mean, just take a look at all the things that just spit in the face of God. God is so good. He is so merciful. He's so tolerant of his wayward children. We're like petulant children. We want our way. We reject God, you know? There's consequence for sin. There is consequence for the rejection of God's law, period. I'm not going to water it down for you. I'm an advocate of mercy. I'm a believer in God's mercy. I rely and trust in God's mercy. But I'm also not delusional. Now, you can look back across the span of history. From the Old Testament, you can see the consequence for those who rejected God. But you can see it, especially in our own day and age. I'll take you back just 100 years. Take you back to the time of Fatima, Portugal, where the Virgin warned. She says, these things don't have to happen. Pray the rosary. Pray for the conversion of Russia. Kids didn't even know who Russia was. They thought it was a horse. They didn't know who it was. It was somebody's horse. And what did we see? We saw this in La Salette. We saw it in Fatima. We see it in a lot of these places. Mankind fails to respond. We saw the rise of atheistic communism. We saw the eradication of nations. We saw the Holy Father having much to suffer. All of this has been predicted by the Mother of God. All of it, right? All of that. So I think personally today we live in this great period of mercy. And as the Lord said, I first come as a just judge. First, I come as a merciful Savior. But woe to those of you who don't recognize this time of my visitation. Because, you know, justice follows mercy. That's what's going to happen here. We're in this great period of mercy. But I hope those works somehow manifest. I hope somehow they're resurrected. I hope we learn what Faustina wrote on them. She did write in her diary here, and I only have a minute or two left, so maybe either later today or maybe tomorrow, I'll share with you a little bit more about the diary. Some call this this book, one of the most important books in the world after the Bible. It doesn't just record the inspiring life of St. Faustina, but it records the words of Jesus Christ himself. It documents profound spiritual events that not only shaped her life, but really shaped the world. And the true purpose of the diary was really to document these instructions to Jesus, because he wanted this new devotion. He wanted divine mercy formed. He wanted it spread. He wanted to give you and I the prayer we're about to pray. He wanted the chaplet of divine mercy to be prayed. And there is a power in that prayer, and it is manifest, and you will see it. If you pray it with trust, if you pray it from your heart, if you believe what the Lord has said, you know, this is an incredibly special day, the day that Faustina began rewriting her diary. As I said, it contains the words Jesus spoke. You know, he wanted the Feast of Mercy proclaimed. He wanted so many things, gave us the image. All of this is chronicled in her diary. And, you know, one of the very first points to note regarding the diary is what Jesus instructed her. Spiritual, it's a couple of spiritual directions. Father Sapochko and another priest, you know, to write these events in her diary. And she records in her diary that if she had not been instructed to do so, both by Jesus, but more importantly by her spiritual director, she never would have wrote the diary. Never, never. She had a third grade education. It's all Faustina had. You think she wanted to sit down and be a scribe? The Lord called her the secretary of his mercy. I have chosen you to be the secretary of my mercy. And listen to this powerful promise. And to prepare the world for my return.